Part 1, Chapter 4, Egyptian Mythology. Teenagers in the American public school system are required to learn all about the ancient Greek gods and Greek myths. I myself recall being required to read books about them, write reports on them, create book projects and presentations, etc. Scores of modern movies and novels have been created based upon and influenced by them. Countless facets of Western art and culture are founded upon the characters and tales of the Greek gods and heroes. Later, the Romans incorporated those same Greek gods into their own theology and worship, merely changing the names from Greek to Latin. According to academia today, there's no clear origin of Greek mythology, and several theories have been offered. However, according to the modern mystery schools, there's absolutely no confusion as to the origin. The philosophers of Greece were initiated into the Egyptian mystery schools and based their gods and mythology upon the gods and mythology of Egypt. All this takes on an entirely new meaning when confronted with the fact that the priests, adepts, and initiates of these ancient religions, these ancient systems of worship, mystery schools, were acutely aware of an extremely relevant esoteric interpretation of all of these ancient stories, myths, figures, legends, and beliefs. Quoting again from Manly P. Hall's book, Freemasonry of the Ancient Egyptians, quote, "We cannot be deceived by the obvious, nor allow ourselves to be misdirected by the evident subterfuges, editor's note, i.e. deceptions, of these ancient Egyptian priests, who so carefully concealed their arcana from the uninitiated world, that we at this late time may even doubt its existence. The ignorant, even among the Egyptians, might derive their inspirations from the processionals and rituals of the state religion. But those great philosophers who came from afar were in search of the highest form of human knowledge and could not be satisfied by such outer show. Had these fables been but hollow and unsubstantial forms, Egypt would have been the ridicule of the wise, who would speedily have exposed her sham and reduced her vain pretense to a humble state. But this did not occur. The initiates of her mysteries, returning to their own countries, not only felt themselves more than repaid for their hazardous journeys and long vigils, but furthermore, they became founders of distinguished systems of thinking, disseminators of useful knowledge, and in all cases bore witness to a broad and deep learning." End quote. The Greek philosophers whom the world honors so highly today, and whose works constitute much of the foundation of modern secular Western thought, did not themselves knowingly worship actual beings by the names of Zeus, Poseidon, Hades, Aphrodite, etc. The Egyptian, Greek, and Roman adepts knew exactly who or what concepts these fabled characters symbolized, and to what they actually referred. While these initiates in the mystery schools vaulted themselves above their fellow men, they, intentionally or not, allowed the exploitation of the masses, through gullibility and ignorance, into venerating and worshiping the dumb idols and outward exoteric symbols of a hidden esoteric theology, even purposefully keeping in ignorance most of the students of their schools as to the correct interpretation of these stories and symbols. They fed the uninitiated nothing but fragmentary philosophical concepts in order to make them feel as though they were approaching the profound levels of wisdom and learning of their master teachers, building within them a truly baseless sense of pride and accomplishment. Quote, "Oh, that cunning plan of the evil one! Oh, the vainness, and the frailties, and the foolishness of men! When they are learned, they think they are wise, and they hearken not unto the counsel of God, for they set it aside, supposing they know of themselves. Wherefore, their wisdom is foolishness, and it profiteth them not, and they shall perish. But to be learned is good, if they hearken unto the counsels of God." End quote. Nephi's younger brother, Jacob. Footnote 1. Is it any wonder the Lord made the first of the Ten Commandments as direct and simple as, quote, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," end quote. Exodus 20, verse 3. All the other gods that these ancient people worshipped were not only not gods, they were exoteric shams concocted by the mystery school adepts, who constructed these symbolic veneers to intentionally disguise their true theology from the masses, their secret worship of Lucifer. In order to more fully grasp the symbolism used by all modern secret societies, i.e., the modern mystery schools, it is important to become familiar with the most pertinent of the ancient Egyptian myths, specifically that concerning the gods Osiris, Isis, and Horus, the perpetual Assyrian cycle, and their conflict with Set, or also known as Typhon. It is critical to have a basic knowledge of these things because these gods, i.e., the symbols and myths they represent, are extremely relevant to and referenced repeatedly within the modern secret societies. The Fable of Osiris. Once again, I quote liberally from Manly P. Hall's book Freemasonry of the Ancient Egyptians, because he gives a thorough and straightforward overview of the mythology of Osiris, Isis, and Horus. He then proceeds to expound on these mythological gods or concepts from a Masonic esoteric perspective. Refer to Appendix B for further information on each of the characters mentioned within the fable. While these stories may come off as trite, ridiculous, dogmatic hyperbole to the modern, educated reader, in truth these myths conceal the core doctrine of the mystery schools, both ancient and modern. These myths are essential and as esoterically meaningful to the initiates of the mystery schools as the doctrine of the war in heaven is to the Latter-day Saints. They are truly as pivotal to the mystery schools as the events of the book of Genesis are to ancient Israel and Judeo-Christian theology. As you read, keep in mind that everything that is quoted was composed by one of the most accomplished and celebrated Masonic writers of all time, addressing Masonic readers who seek a greater understanding of deeper Masonic core theology. Quote, "The fable of Isis and Osiris, as it has descended to us in the account given by Plutarch, has not been greatly amplified by any modern research. The Egyptian fragments which have been translated in recent years offer no complete account of the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Osiris. Nor has any new key been found to unlock this great drama, which may well be termed the Passion Play of Egypt. It is not our intention to perpetuate Plutarch's account merely for its outward appearance, but rather from the same motive that inspired Synesius, Platonic philosopher and Christian bishop, to compile his account of the same fabulous history. Synesius, in his treatise on Providence, thus introduces the Osirian myth." Quoting Synesius, "This fable is Egyptian. The Egyptians transcend in wisdom. Perhaps, therefore, this also being a fable, obscurely signifies something more than a fable, because it is Egyptian. If, however, it is not a fable, but a sacred discourse, it will deserve in a still greater degree to be told, and committed to writing." End quote, Synesius. In presenting a summary of Plutarch's account, I am omitting nothing which could in any way be regarded as relevant. I am taking the liberty, however, of somewhat expanding the fable by incorporating therein some small fragments derived from other Greek writers, and occasionally a few words bearing upon the account from fragments from Egyptian religious literature. The story, then, is in substance as follows. The goddess Nut, whom Plutarch identifies with Rhea, one of the Titans in Greek mythology, was the daughter of Shu and Tefnut. She is the wife of Seb and the mother of Ra. If we are to trust Plutarch, she afterwards became the wife of Ra, or the sun. Nut is unfaithful to Ra, who, discovering that she is with child by Seb, pronounces a curse upon her that she should not be delivered of her progeny in any month or year. Thoth, Hermes or Mercury, who is also in love with Nut, comes to her assistance with a stratagem. He plays at tables with the moon goddess Selene, and wins from her the seventh part of each of her illuminations. And joining these parts together, he forms of them 5 days, which he adds to the calendar. Previous to that time, the Egyptian year consisted of 360 days. Editor's note, the number of degrees in a circle. These 5 days, being not part of any month or year, Ra was outwitted. Upon these days, Nut brought forth her 5 children at different times and different places. Upon the first of these days she brought forth Osiris, and the place of his birth, according to Diodorus, was Mount Nissa, in Arabia the Happy. Mount Nissa is now Mount Sinai. At the moment of the birth of Osiris, a voice sounded throughout the world saying, "The Lord of all the earth is born." On the second day, Nut gave birth to Eurus, the elder Horus. On the third day, Typhon, or Set. On the fourth day, Isis. And on the fifth and last day, Nephthys. The Egyptians, therefore, regard the 5 days, which they term the epact, or superadded, as the birthdays of the gods, especially venerating the fourth of them, upon which the benevolent goddess Isis came into being. Plutarch further on announces that the 5 children of Nut were not all of the same father, thus contradicting his earlier statement. He says that Osiris and the elder Horus were the children of Ra, that Isis was the daughter of Thoth, and only Typhon and Nephthys were actually the offspring of Seb. There is another and even more recondite legend regarding the elder Horus, which denies him the fathership of Ra, declaring him to be the offspring of Osiris and Isis while they were still in the womb of Nut. These accounts we shall consider later. Osiris was given to Pamiles to be educated, and having come to the years of majority, became the king of Egypt. In this high capacity, Osiris applied himself to the civilizing of his nation, turning the Egyptians from their previously indigent and barbarous course of life to a happy and community existence. He taught them agriculture, compiled for them a body of laws for the regulation of conduct, instructed them in the reverencing and worship of the gods, thus establishing Egypt in all the essentials of truth. Having brought his own nation to prosperity and enlightenment, Osiris traveled over the rest of the world, converting peoples to his discipline, not by force, but through persuasion of reason. Osiris was accompanied on this journey by a procession of nymphs and other superphysical beings who filled the air with music and song. In the meantime, Typhon, brother or half-brother of Osiris, had ambition to usurp the throne, but the vigilant Isis, sister-wife of Osiris, was too watchful. Typhon, however, having persuaded 72 other persons to join him in his conspiracy, with the aid of a certain queen in Ethiopia named Aso, perfected a plot against Osiris. He fashioned a chest exactly to the measure of the body of Osiris, which chest he caused to be brought into the banquet hall, where the princes of Egypt were feasting their king's return. Typhon, simulating jest, promised this elaborately ornamented box to the one whose body, upon trial, most nearly fitted it. Each of the princes in turn lay down in the box, but each was too short or too tall, until last of all Osiris himself lay down in it. Immediately the 72 conspirators rushed to the box, clamped the cover upon it, fastened it with nails, and poured melted lead over all the cracks and crevices. After this they carried the chest to the bank of the Nile and cast it into the river where it joins the sea. As soon as Isis received word of this crime, she cut off one of the locks of her hair and put on the mourning apparel of widowhood, for which reason the spot where she did this was afterwards called Coptis, or the city of mourning. After donning the widow's weeds, Isis set forth in search of her husband's body and wandered about all Egypt, asking all with whom she came in contact. Finally, some children who had been at play told her that they've seen the accomplices of Typhon carrying the chest to the Nile. For that reason, Egyptians regard the words of children as oracular and pay great attention to them. While Isis was searching for her husband's body, she learned that Nephthys, her sister, had by magic insinuated herself into the presence of Osiris before his death, and in the guise of Isis had conceived a son from him. Isis sought out the child which Nephthys had deserted for fear of Typhon's anger, and adopting it, attached it to her person as a constant guard and attendant. This was Anubis, the dog-headed god who appears in the Book of the Dead. Isis learned that the chest had been carried by the sea to the coast of Byblos. Editor's note, Byblos is also the name for book or Bible, where it had lodged in the branches of a bush of tamarisk, which had grown up miraculously about the sacred receptacle and concealed it within its trunk. The king of Byblos, amazed at the miracle, caused the tree to be cut down, and from the trunk, containing the box, he made a pillar to support the roof of his palace. By magic, Isis discovered this, and, traveling immediately to Byblos, attached herself to the suite of the queen as a nurse to her children. At night, when all the palace was asleep, Isis transformed herself into a swallow and fluttered around the column, bemoaning her fate in strange, sad tones. In due time, Isis revealed her divine nature and asked that the pillar be cut down. Taking therefrom the chest, she departed with it into a desert place, where she performed certain magical rites by which the body of Osiris was temporarily animated, and by this animation she received from Osiris a son, who was called the younger Horus, the child who was conceived of the dead. There is some confusion in the account at this point. Plutarch says that Isis left the body of Osiris temporarily to visit her son Horus, just mentioned. But the context of the fable would rather call for her departure to a secluded place where the child could be born without the knowledge of Typhon, who certainly would have destroyed him. Isis hid the chest in a remote and unfrequented place, but Typhon, hunting one night by the light of the moon, chanced upon it. Knowing its contents and realizing Isis to be proficient in magic, he resolved to thwart her purposes. And tearing the body into 14 parts, he scattered them over Egypt. From the inscriptions on the Metternich stele, editor's note, a stele, S-T-E-L-E, is a metal, stone, or wooden slab, generally taller than it is wide, erected for funerals or commemorative purposes. A tombstone would be considered a stele. Footnote 2. It seems that Set, Typhon, must have imprisoned Isis and her son Horus. The goddess is made to say, "I am Isis, and I came forth from the house wherein my brother Set has placed me." Thoth, the prince of law, again came to her assistance and aided Isis to escape from the house, or was it really a prison? Editor's note, or could it have been the house of Set, Typhon? Thoth also, at this time, prophesied that Horus would sit upon the throne of his father and rule the double empire of Egypt. Upon the advice of Thoth, Isis hides the child in a papyrus swamp, thus saving him from the wrath of Set. Isis, returning, having left her son at Butos, and fashioning a magical boat out of papyrus, traversed the whole of the empire. As she met with the scattered parts of her husband, she buried each one separately, first, however, encasing it in a magical mummy composed of wax, incense, and grain seed. She finally recovered all of the parts of Osiris except the phallus, editor note, i.e. the penis, which had been thrown into the river and devoured by three fishes, editor's note. Keep the three fishes in mind. This organ Isis reproduced in gold, and having performed all the ceremonies necessary to ensure the life of Osiris in the underworld, she returned to her son Horus, and by the thergic arts, of which she was mistress, saved him from death from the sting of scorpions. Horus, having grown to a man's estate, and having received from his mother the tradition of his father's murder, longed to avenge the evil deed. Osiris appeared to his son in a vision, instructing him in the means by which he could overcome the hosts of Typhon. We are led to infer that Horus gathered about him an army which, meeting the hosts of Typhon, battled with them for many days, achieving victory. Typhon was taken prisoner and turned over to the custody of Isis. Isis, being his sister, could not bring herself to put him to death, but set him at liberty, which so incensed Horus that he laid hands upon his mother and removed from her head the insignia of royalty. Thereupon Thoth gave her a new helmet made in the shape of an ox's head. Typhon next accused Horus of illegitimacy, but Thoth proves his royal descent. Typhon again goes into battle against Horus. In fact, two battles are mentioned, in both of which Typhon is worsted, and Horus regains the kingdom of his father and is regarded, to at least a certain degree, as the actual incarnation of Osiris. After its resurrection in the underworld, the shade of Osiris visits Isis, and in consequence thereof, she gives birth to another son, as it were, by a holy ghost, for she knew no living man. This child is called Harpocrates, and Plutarch says of him that he came into the world before his time and lame in his lower limbs. Harpocrates is usually depicted as a youthful nude figure, his head adorned with a single curling lock of hair on the right side, this being with the Egyptians a symbol of youth or adolescence. He is sometimes depicted with an elaborate plumed headdress or wearing the double crown of the northern and southern empires. His finger is placed to his lips, which Plutarch interprets as a gesture symbolic of his childish and helpless state. The Greeks and Romans, however, consider this gesture to be a symbol for silence, and from this has arisen the custom of placing the finger to the lips as a motion for quietness and secrecy. Editor's note: this ancient gesture is used by just about everyone in every culture in the world today, putting one's index finger over one's lips to signal someone to be quiet. Statues of the god Harpocrates were placed at the entrances to temples and sacred retreats, where the dramas of the mysteries were performed, as a sign that silence and secrecy should be observed in the holy places, and that all initiates were bound by vows of discretion. Harpocrates is sometimes shown standing, and at other times he is depicted seated on a blossom of a lotus. Editor's note: similar to how the Buddha is typically portrayed. Although he is usually figured with childish immaturity or of body, the imperfection of his lower limbs, as described by Plutarch, is not apparent in any of the Egyptian drawings. It therefore seems that the statements concerning this deformity should be more carefully examined. Samuel Squire, whose translation of Plutarch's Isis and Osiris, made in 1744, is still the most often quoted by Egyptologists, states definitely lame in his lower limbs. G.R.S. Meade translated the same essay much later and gives a slightly different rendering of Plutarch's words. Mr. Meade says, quote, weak in his limbs from below upwards, unquote. This difference in wording, though slight, may have an unexpected significance. End quote from Manly P. Hall. Masonic Interpretation of Egyptian Mythology. Later on, in the same work, Hall elaborates upon the esoteric meanings of these characters and events. Quote, from the reign of Osiris, we glean the following philosophical history. There was a time, the Golden Age, when truth and wisdom ruled the earth, and this aristocracy of wisdom was a benevolent despotism in which men were led to a nobler state of being by the firm, kindly hand of the enlightened sage. This was the divine dynasty of the mythological priest-kings, who were qualified to govern humanity by virtue, not only temporal, but by divine attributes. Through his priests, Osiris, representative of the hidden tradition, ruled the entire world by virtue of the perfection resident in that tradition. If we concede that Osiris is the positive pole of the universal life agent, then Isis becomes the receptive pole of that activity. He is the doctrine, she is the church. As in Christianity, it is customary to refer to the church as the bride of Christ. So in Egypt, the institution of the mysteries was the Great Mother, the consort of heaven itself. From this interpretation, we gain a deeper insight into the symbolism of the whole of Osirian cycle. Isis becomes the temporal order of the priesthood, the cumulative body of initiates. She is personified as the temple. She is the mother of all good, the protectress of all right, and the patron of all improvement. She ensures nobility, inspires virtue, and awakens the nobler passions of the soul. As Diana of Ephesus, she, Isis, is the Multimammia who feeds all others from herself. Editor's note, Multimammia means multi-breasted. The Diana of Ephesus figure has breasts all over her torso. Like the moon, she shines only with the light of her sovereign sun, even as a temple can only be illumined by its indwelling truth. Editor's note, the temple areas within all Masonic lodges do not have windows wherewith outside light filters in. They are completely lighted from within. End quote, Manly P. Hall. What has Mr. Hall revealed here? Osiris represents the otherworldly delivered doctrine of the mystery schools, or, as it is referred to in Judeo-Christian literature, Mystery Babylon. Isis represents the priesthood of Mystery Babylon, the temporal order of the priesthood, the accumulative body of initiates. Hall even provides an unmistakable Christian comparison, as the bride of Christ represents Christ's church as a whole, i.e., those who have been baptized and taken upon themselves the name of Christ, covenanting to serve Him. Isis represents the collective body of Mystery Babylon's initiates, i.e., those who have undertaken the rites and oaths and vows of secrecy, covenanting to serve, obey, and be perfectly loyal to his superior officer without exception. The mystery schools refer to her as the Great Mother, the consort of heaven. The books of 1 Nephi and Revelation refer to her as the mother of harlots and the whore of all the earth, drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. The Golden Age of Egypt was the period of time in which the populace was ruled by a Luciferian system, an enforced benevolent despotism in which men were led to a nobler state of being by the firm, kindly hand of the enlightened sage, priesthood, who were qualified to govern humanity by virtue, not only temporal, but by divine attributes. Hitler and Mussolini described their despotism in benevolent terms as well. Hall continues, quote, Typhon lured Osiris into the Ark of Destruction at the time when the sun enters the house of the scorpion, editor's notes, i.e. the zodiac reference to the period of time in which this happened. Hence, we know him to be the eternal betrayer, that ageless Judas, who undoes all good things and inevitably presages ruin. He is the power of the physical universe, which is constantly seeking to destroy the spiritual values locked within its substances. Of all good things, Typhon is the opposer, occupying the position of eternal negative. This monster may well be generalized under the appellation of the adversary. In the initiation rites, he is also the tester or the trier, the Lord who is against us. He is the personification of ambition, and ambition is the patron of ruin. It was ambition that set Typhon plotting for the throne of Egypt, designing how he should destroy the power of his brother. Typhon is the embodiment of every perversity. He is the negative creation, the Ahriman, editor's note, meaning, i.e., the destructive spirit, of Zoroastrianism. Typhon is black magic and sorcery, the black brotherhood. Nephthys, his wife, is the institution through which it manifests. He is neither a single evil nor even a sequence of ills, but an infinite diversity of them, indescribably insidious, empowered to infect the fabric of church and state. End quote. Who or what is Typhon according to the esoteric doctrine of the mystery schools? He is Jesus Christ. Nephthys represents the kingdom of God on earth. Quote, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness. End quote. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20. Quote, Typhon lured Osiris into the ark of destruction. End quote. Christ cast down Lucifer. Quote, Typhon undoes all good things and inevitably presages ruin. End quote. All the machinations and lies of Lucifer and his followers inevitably come to naught, their conspiring works exposed and decimated. Quote, he is the power of the physical universe, which is constantly seeking to destroy the spiritual values locked within its substances. End quote. The light of Christ, the conscience, imbued within the soul of every human born on this earth, constantly seeks to persuade mankind to forego pride for empathy, guides to overcome the natural man, or the temptations of evil spirits, to which all flesh is prone. Quote, Typhon is the embodiment of every perversity. He is the negative creation. He is black magic and sorcery, the black brotherhood. End quote. The priesthood of the Church of the Lamb, the Melchizedek and Aaronic priesthoods, the power of Almighty God granted unto normal common men who have covenanted with Christ to keep his commandments, who have kept themselves clean of the world, who love God with all their might, mind, and strength. This is what the mystery schools call every perversity, negative creation, and black magic and sorcery. Quote, empowered to infect the fabric of church and state. Unquote. The plain and simple universal truths of Judeo-Christian theology, such as the Ten Commandments, have been maliciously categorized as infecting secular institutions in recent decades, and have been increasingly discredited or brushed aside in modern popular religion. This will be covered further in later chapters. Hall continues, quote, Typhon is the desire of the few, pitted against the good of the many. He is the spirit of dissension and discord that breaks up unity of purpose by setting factions against each other, so that great issues lose the name of action. The desire for riches, pomp, power, and sovereignty, by which this evil genius was obsessed, reveals the temptation by which humanity is deflected from its ultimate goal and led into the byways of sorrow and despair. End quote. Quote, Typhon is the desire of the few pitted against the good of the many. End quote. This is the thinly veiled, infinitely hypocritical rhetoric of socialism. Quote, the desire for riches, pomp, power, and sovereignty by which this evil genius was obsessed. End quote. Riches, pomp, power. Uncannily similar charges were accused of Alma the high priest by the Antichrist Korihor in chapter 30 of the Book of Alma in the Book of Mormon. However, to be charged with obsessing over sovereignty, who else would consider a desire for sovereignty, i.e. liberty, self-determination, free will, an evil but a hardcore communist or socialist? Quote, the obsession with sovereignty reveals the temptation by which humanity is deflected from its ultimate goal. Unquote. What is the ultimate goal of Lucifer? To perfect mankind through force, denying them of their God-given gift of free agency to choose their destiny for themselves. Quote, and led into the byways of sorrow and despair. End quote. Free agency invariably exposes mankind to sorrow and despair, from which escape and redemption is made possible through the atonement of Christ. Strict demarcation between the exoteric and the esoteric. At a later point, Mr. Hall introduces a critical concept while elaborating on the writings of Synesius concerning the ceremony of Osiris's election. Quote, Osiris receives from his father an elaborate dissertation in the Platonic temper concerning the relative power of good and evil in which he is fully warned against the machinations of Typhon. Possibly the most important sentence in Synesius' treatise occurs during this dissertation. The father of Osiris is made to say to his son, quote, "You have been initiated in those mysteries in which there are two pairs of eyes, and it is requisite that the pair which are beneath should be closed when the pair that are above them perceive. And when the pair above are closed, those which are beneath should be opened." End quote and end quote, Mr. Hall. The two pairs of eyes represent incorporating two completely different personas or mindsets. One is for the public, for the outside world, for the profane to witness. The other is strictly private, for the esoteric realm, the world of mystery school initiates. The pair which are beneath should be closed when the pair that are above them perceive, refers to the initiate psychologically shutting out anything and everything which harkens back to the esoteric realm while in the profane public world. The profane must never glimpse nor suspect that there is anything beyond the public persona one presents to them. The initiate must convince all others, even close friends and relatives, that this public persona is everything there is to know about him. When the pair above are closed, those that are beneath should be opened, refers to the initiate psychologically closing off his public persona once he has entered the sacred mystery school esoteric realms. He is then at liberty to become his true self and shut off the fraudulent identity which he fosters and perpetuates before the public. This kind of persona switching is by no means unique to mystery school initiates. Serial killers become expert at it in order to pass as upstanding citizens. It is also identical to this kind of skills cultivated by professional actors and actresses. No matter how convincing a talented actor may perform his role, it is not a representation of his true self. All too often, actors convincingly portray honest, stalwart, innocent men while simultaneously leading personal lives of moral emptiness, corruption, and deceit. Mystery school initiates must likewise develop such skills and deploy them on an ongoing basis to perform their duties. The core doctrine of Mystery Babylon is the inverse of true Christianity. The mythology of Osiris, Isis, and Horus is the core doctrine at the heart of all the mystery schools. It is the essence of their symbology, fraternal theology, and worship. Everything is traced back to the arcane and occult of Egypt. Their modern beliefs, rites, and worship all relate back to this. Egypt and Greek symbolic and mythical themes occur repeatedly in the modern mystery schools and are incorporated in their priestcrafts and rites. Realize that all of this is the inverse of true Christianity, the fullness of the gospel. Christ's doctrine is plain and easy to be understood, especially the doctrine of the war in heaven. God the Father and His chosen Son, Jesus Christ, established this earth as a proving ground for His spirit children to obtain physical bodies, with an environment wherein they can exercise their own free agency, requiring an atonement to be made by Christ in order to provide a way of redemption. Lucifer proposed an alternate system which would replace free agency with benevolent force, causing all mankind to go through the process of obtaining physical bodies but not actually learning or experiencing anything of their own volition, thus negating the need for an atonement and all mankind being saved by default, thanks to the leadership of Lucifer, in which all mankind would owe him eternal gratitude and everlasting debt. Lucifer's proposal was rejected. Out of fury and pride, he persuaded a third of the spirit hosts to make war against those loyal to Christ and the archangel Michael, Adam, who led them. As a result, Lucifer and all the spirits who followed him were imprisoned on the earth, eternally forbidden from receiving their own physical bodies. And here they have remained for thousands of years, desperate to trick, succor, tempt, and deceive us, vulnerable and gullible humans as we struggle for redemption. In the core doctrine of the mystery schools, everything good, especially the human intellect, is either embodied in or emanates from Lucifer. Everything they describe as good is sin by Christian standards, and all of mankind's blessings are credited to Lucifer. That which the mystery schools describe as evil, and all that which is truly evil, is credited to Jesus Christ, as well as anything that glorifies Him. Again, Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20, quote, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." End quote. For those of us who have a testimony of Christ and who understand correct, plain, and precious, uncorrupted doctrine, it is possible to increasingly discern that that which lies beneath the multiple layers of exoteric symbology is nothing more than an inversion of Christ's gospel. It is a rewrite of celestial events, pitting Lucifer as a betrayed, unjustly imprisoned deity, seeking merely to raise all of mankind from the lowliest of ignorant peasantry to the pinnacle that the dormant intellect of man can achieve, against a malevolent, suppressive Jehovah who permits the existence of squalor, ignorance, stupidity, anarchy, and every form of unadulterated evil, who is, supposedly, willing to indefinitely condemn all but the few who submit their will and intellect to Him. This is what lies at the very heart of all non-truly Christian theologies. All other religions on earth, including all fraternities and secular creeds, have perpetuated, disseminated, or branched off from the ancient mystery schools. Initiation into the Egyptian Mysteries. The following comes from a book called A History of Secret Societies, first published in 1961 and authored by Arkan Daral. As it turns out, this Arkan Daral is strongly suspected to be a pseudonym of Idris Shah, footnote 3, a noted author and historian who focused primarily on Sufi traditions. This conclusion is reached because Shah used a number of pseudonyms, footnote 4, an author by the name of Arkan Daral has never published any other known books, and there is no information available about his identity. The writing style of this book closely matches that of Shah's, and Shah actually quotes from this book in a work that he published only 3 years later. In this part of the book, Shah does an admirable job of introducing and summarizing the content of a German document published in 1785, which details the procedures of an ancient Egyptian initiation called the Krata Repoa. A copy of this document, translated in English, is provided in the supporting material, footnote 5. Quote, "The most detailed account on what was said to be the seven highest degrees of secret Egyptian initiation was first published in Germany in the 18th century. This strange and very exhaustive document combines many elements from the ancient mysteries. It seems to come from Greek sources, because many of the words used are Greek. And it could well be that we have here the modern beginnings of an attempted revival of ancient mysteries. Whatever it is not one of those fanciful and spurious ones which used to be printed merely to attract the credulous, because it is plausible in containing the sort of material which might well have formed the content of an initiation and mind-conditioning system. The earliest version known is in the form of an anonymous pamphlet, probably not intended for public sale, of 30-odd pages, which was printed in 1785. It was republished in a French translation 30 years later, purporting to be the ritual of the master degree in Freemasonry. The French editor claims that it is a composite ritual derived from the works of some 15 Greek and Roman writers. This degree, we are told, was open to Egyptian kings and priests alone, and only those specially recommended by an initiate could enter it. The usual procedure was that the pharaoh himself introduced the candidate to the priests. By them he sent, from Heliopolis, editor's note, which means City of the Sun, to the Memphis priests. From there he went to Thebes. He was circumcised, forbidden to eat pulse, editor's note, i.e. legumes such as peas or beans, or fish, and generally had to abstain from wine. He was put for several months in an underground cave and asked to write down his reflections. When he had done this, he was led to a passage supported by the pillars of Hermes, where he had to learn certain things which were inscribed thereon. As soon as he was word perfect, the Themorphus, introducer, came to him with a strong whip to keep the uninitiated at bay. He was blindfolded and his hands bound with cords. First degree. Now follows the procedure from the first degree of this elect body. The candidate was led to the gate of men, where the inducer touched the shoulder of an apprentice, Portophorus, standing there on guard. He in turn knocked on the gate, which was opened. When the aspirant entered, he was questioned on various matter by the hierophant, after which he was led around the Berantha in an artificial storm of wind, rain, thunder, and lightning. If he showed no sign of fear, Menes, the expounder, explained the laws of the Kratarapoa, to which he had to agree. He was then taken in front of the hierophant, made to kneel, and vowed fidelity with a sword point at his throat. As witnesses, he called upon the sun, moon, and stars. End quote. Recall that, to the mystery schools, the sun represents Lucifer and his doctrine, the moon represents his priesthood order and organization, and the stars represent the individual initiates. Continuing to quote from A History of Secret Societies. Quote, his eyes were then unbandaged, and he was placed between two spare pillars, called bedelis, where lay a ladder of 7 steps, behind which were doors of different metals of gradually increasing purity. The hierophant, then addressing those present as Mene Musae, or children of the work of celestial investigation, exhorted them to govern their passions and fix their thoughts upon God. The candidate was taught that the latter symbolized the wanderings of the soul. He was told the causes of wind, thunder, and lightning, and given other valuable information, such as medical lore. He was given the password of recognition of this degree, which was Amun, meaning secrecy. He was taught a grip, given a pyramidal cap, and an apron called Xylon. Around his neck was a collar, and he wore no other clothes. His duty was to guard the gate of men in his turn. Second degree. The Portophorus was now able, after showing his devotion, to proceed to the second degree. Following a prolonged fast, he was taken to a dark chamber called Endymion, the invitation grotto. He was now of the degree of Neocorus. Handsome women brought him dainty food. They were the wives of the priests, who endeavored to excite his love. If he resisted these advances, he was further lectured by the master of ceremonies and led to an assembly where the stolista, or water bearer, poured water over him. Then a living serpent was thrown at him. The whole room was full of snakes to test his courage. He was then led to 2 high pillars. Between stood a griffin driving a wheel before him. The pillars symbolized east and west, the griffin the sun, and the wheel of four spokes, the four seasons. He was taught the use of the level and instructed in geometry and architecture. He received a rod entwined by serpents, and he received the password Hevi, meaning serpent, and was told the story of the fall of man. The sign consisted in crossing the arms over the chest, and his duty was to wash the pillars. End quote. This rod is called a caduceus. In Greek mythology, it was the staff carried by Mercury as messenger of the gods. Today, both the caduceus and the rod of Asclepius, a symbol of a single snake wrapped around a rod, are used extensively by the medical profession and the U.S. Army Medical Corps. You see this symbol just about everywhere today, even on ambulances. It has become synonymous with the medical profession. Many say that it represents Moses' brass serpent entwined on a pole or possibly a cross, which, when the Israelites looked upon, they were miraculously cured of their snake bites. This cannot be true, as the symbols used in the medical profession frequently appear with wings or in other ways that are consistent with the esoteric symbolism of ancient Egypt and not those of Judeo-Christianity. Third degree. Quote, when the candidate was initiated into the third degree, the member was given the title Melanophorus. He was led to an anteroom over whose door was written Gate of Death. The room was full of copies, editor's note, reproductions, of embalmed bodies and coffins. Here, too, were a number of dissectors, embalmers, and so on. In the center stood the coffin of Osiris. The Melanophorus was asked if he had a hand in the assassination of his master. On his denying the question, he was seized by two Tapiexites, or men who buried the dead, and led into a hall where he found all the other Melanophores clothed in black. The king himself, who always was present on these occasions, addressed him in an apparently friendly way, begging him, if he did not feel courage enough to undergo the test now to be applied to him, to accept the golden crown he was offering him. He had already been coached to refuse the crown and tread it underfoot. At this insult, the king called for revenge. Raising his sacrificial axe, he touched the head of the initiate. The two corpse carriers threw him to the ground, and the embalmers wrapped him in bandages. All who were present wept. Now he was led to a gate over which was written Sanctuary of the Spirits. On its being opened, thunder and lightning struck the apparently dead man. Charon received him as a spirit into his boat and carried him to the judges of Hades. Pluto sat on his judgment seat, while Rhadamanthus and Minos, as well as Aethon, Nicreus, Alastor, and Orpheus, stood beside him. Very severe questions were put to him as to his former life, and finally he was sentenced to remain in the subterranean vaults. End quote. The initiate could have been required to remain within these vaults for months, or possibly even years. Continuing to quote, quote, the bandages were removed, and he was told never to desire blood, never to leave a corpse unburied, and to believe in the resurrection of the dead and the judgment to come. He was taught coffin decoration and the peculiar hierogrammatical script. The sign was an embrace to express the days of wrath. He was kept in these underground chambers until thought fit to proceed to a higher degree. These days of wrath generally lasted for a year and a half, until the initiate was ready for promotion to the fourth degree, the Battle of the Shades. Fourth degree. He was handed a sword and a shield, and taken through dark passages. He met certain persons, presenting frightful appearances, carrying torches and serpents. He was attacked with the cry of Panis. He defended himself bravely, but was taken prisoner. His eyes were bandaged, and a cord placed around his neck. Dragging him into a hall, the specters disappeared. He was led into the assembly of initiates, and his eyes unbandaged. Before him, he saw a magnificent hall, decorated with beautiful paintings. The king and the highest dignitary, the demiurgos, were present. All were wearing their alidae, an Egyptian order composed of sapphires. Among those present were the secretary, the treasurer, and the master of feats. The orator made a speech congratulating the new member on his fortitude. He was given a drink called sais, which he drank to the dregs. This was probably the ritual drink of honey or milk, water, wine, and gruel, and perhaps some hypnotic drug. He donned the boots of Anubis, took up the shield of Isis, put on the cloak and cap of Orcus. He was handed a sword and told that he must cut off the head of the next person he met in a cave and bring it back to the king. This cave was pointed to him. Entering it, he saw what seemed to be a beautiful woman, but in reality was a model of one. Note, keep in mind that this is a woman. He seized this by the hair and severed the head. This he brought back to the monarch, who praised him, telling him that he had symbolically won the head of the Gorgon, wife of Typhon, who had caused the death of Osiris. End quote. Recall that Typhon represents Jesus Christ, and his wife, the Gorgon, also known as Medusa, represents his kingdom, or, in other words, Christ's church, which is represented in the Bible as the bride of Christ. Ponder that next time you're inclined to cheer for a Greek hero who has beheaded Medusa. Continuing to quote, quote, "He was not permitted always to wear the dress which had been given to him, and he was entered in a book as one of the judges of the land. He was able to communicate at any time with the king, and received an allowance from the court. He was invested with an order, that of Isis, in the shape of an owl, and it was revealed to him that the secret name of the lawgiver was Joa, which was also the password of this degree. But the password for the meetings of the Christophori, as the fourth degree initiates were called, was Sasichis, the fifth degree. The fifth degree, that of Balahate, could not now be refused to the Christophorus. He was led to a hall to watch a play, at which he was the only looker. Other members of the degree went through the hall as if looking for something. One drew this sword, and the terrible figure of Typhon appeared. He was slain. Now the new Balahate was told that Typhon represented fire, a terrible element, which was at the same time indispensable. The password was Chemia, and the teaching was in chemistry, or alchemy. Sixth degree. In order to become an astronomer at the gate of the gods, the sixth degree, the candidate was taken to the hall of assembly, bound, and led to the gate of death. He was shown corpses which had been cast into the water, and warned that he might be similarly treated if he broke his oath. He was given some teaching in astronomy and taken back to the gate of the gods, where he looked at the pictures of the gods while their histories were explained to him. A priestly dance took place, symbolizing the course of the heavenly bodies. He saw a list of members of the order throughout the world and learned the password, Ibis, for watchfulness. End quote. Realize that not until this sixth degree was conferred upon the initiate did he actually learn who belonged to the order. Only at this level are the identities of equal and lower initiates bestowed. And note that the initiates are spread throughout the world. seventh and highest degree. Continuing to quote from the book, quote, "The last and the highest degree was that of prophetah, in which all secrets were laid bare. It was conferred following public processions and when the permission of the king and all the highest members had been obtained. The members secretly left the city by night and retired to some houses built in a square and surrounded by pillars by the sides of which were placed alternately a shield and a coffin, whose rooms were painted with representations of human life. These houses were called maneras, for the people believed them to be visited by the manes of departed men. On their arrival at these houses, the new member, now called Prophet or Saphenath-Panchah, a man who knows the secrets, was given a drink called Oimalas and told that now all trials were over. He received a cross of peculiar significance, which he was always to wear. He was clothed in a wide, white-striped dress called Itagi. The usual sign was crossing his arms in his wide sleeves. He could peruse all the sacred books written in the Ammonite language. His greatest privilege was having a vote in the election of a king, and the password was Adon." End quote. Footnotes. Footnote 1. 2 Nephi chapter 9, verses 28 and 29, the Book of Mormon. Footnote 2. The Metternich steel referenced here is currently housed in the Egyptian collection at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Footnote 3. Quote, Idris Shah, 16th June 1924 to 23rd November 1999, was an author and teacher in the Sufi tradition who wrote over 36 critically acclaimed books on topics ranging from psychology and spirituality to travelogues and culture studies. Born in India, the descendant of a family of Afghan nobles, Shah grew up mainly in England. His early writings centered on magic and witchcraft. His most seminal work was The Sufis, which appeared in 1964 and was well received internationally. In his writings, Shah presented Sufism as a universal form of wisdom that predated Islam. End quote. Source, Wikipedia, Idris Shah, that's I-D-R-I-E-S, underscore, Shah, S-H-A-H. Footnote 4, quote, Shah has conceded his own recourse to pen names without divulging details. Many of his disciples emulate him. Given this obfuscation, it is problematic which of the score or more queerly named authors stylistically and thematically assignable to the Shah school, e.g. Omar Michael Burke, Ph.D., Arkan Daral, Raphael Lefort, Hadrad B. M. Deverish, and so on, have independent physical existence? Pending investigation, it perhaps suffices that none show a scintilla of independent philosophical existence. End quote. From Neo-Sufism, The Case of Idris Shah by James Moore. Footnote 5. Refer to the PDF file in the supporting material, Egyptian Initiation, Krata Rapoa.